It's Elise here. Thank you so much for listening again. And as always, welcome if you're a new listener. This is the season one finale, and my good friend Brianne is back for another round of histories and mysteries. So welcome back.
Whoop, whoop.
I'm so happy you're here again. Yeah. This is awesome. Thanks for agreeing to come back again.
It's our holiday get together.
All right. So for those of you who didn't hear the two-part Unsolved Mysteries from Halloween, my good friend Brianne is a very talented woman. She's an amazing photographer, and you can find her on Instagram at Brianne Marie Photo, and I'll have links to her socials and her website up on the blog. Be sure to check her out. And so for this episode, I found some great mysteries from Canada. I'm excited to hear what Brianne thinks about these, especially Canada. And I have one from Alberta.
Whoa.
I know. For those of you who don't know, we are from Alberta. So it was kind of, it's like when you see like a celebrity who's from your hometown or something. Yeah. Like you're just like, so cool.
I'm not into hockey. And last night I saw like a local guy score. I'm like, holy smokes.
Yeah. You like claim their fame mm-hmm. for your own. Okay. So as I said last time, the notion of paranormal encompasses much more areas than spirits and hauntings. It includes things like UFOs, reincarnation, cryptids, and unsolved mysteries. So today I'm going to be telling you about the Dyatlov Pass incident, which I kind of mentioned last time, the Falcon Lake incident, which is Canadian, a reincarnation story, because of course yes. we loved it. Yes. And I heard a lot of people loved the story of Dorothy Edie from last time.
Yeah, unreal.
And then I have the surprise story for you. I'm so excited for that one. But actually, I'm going to do the Alberta story just exclusively on the blog. So that one's going to be really interesting.
Perfect.
Okay, so let's get into these stories. Okay, so this first story is that one that I mentioned last time. This is the Dyatlov Pass incident. So you haven't heard of this, right?
Nope.
Okay, so this one's like a doozy. Oh, it's a huge case. Like every rabbit hole you go down is like there's a million other theories. There's this and that. It's actually so insane.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, once I tell you, you're going to be like, how did I not hear about this? Because literally probably every year it comes back up in the news. They're reinvestigating.
There's a new.
It's crazy.
Lead.
Yeah. So this case began in January of 1959. 10 hikers, 8 men and 2 women set out on a difficult hike through Russia's Ural Mountains. The team was from the Ural Polytechnic Institute and was led by a very experienced hiker, Igor Dyatlov. From further research, the team weren't actually newbies. So every member of the group besides Igor were grade 2 hikers with ski tour experience and would be receiving their grade 3 certification when they returned from the hike. So grade 3 was the highest at that time in the Soviet Union. So they were okay. pretty experienced.
Yeah.
The goal of the hike they were going out on was to make it to the Ortorton Mountain. The names. I'm going to try my best.
Imagine.
Yeah.
Just imagine.
So I'm going to put a map up on the blog so you can see where the trek was meant to go. So the group arrived in a town called Ivdel on the morning of January 25th, 1959. They took a truck to Vizhai, a small village near where the start of their trek would be. The group was noted in the village that night eating bread to keep their energy up for the next day. They spent the night and then set off on their journey on January 27th. On January 28th, one of the hikers, Yuri Yudin, turned back due to knee and joint pain that would make him unable to finish the hike. And I think he had other health problems. He had right. like some sort of like heart problem and stuff like that. So he obviously knew it wasn't going to go well.
He wasn't going to make it. Yeah.
Yeah. So the remaining 9 continued. But before Yuri left, Dyatlov told him that he would send a telegram back for him once they returned to Vizhai to let him know they were back. Everything went well. He guessed that it would be no later than February 12th, but that it could be a little longer. So when 12 days passed with no word, there wasn't immediate concern. But on February 20th, when there was no word, family of the hikers were demanding a rescue op to be dispatched. The head of Ural Polytechnic Institute sent out the first of the rescue groups, which was comprised of students and teachers who were volunteering. The army later became involved and sent planes and helicopters out to help in the search. On February 26th, the search group found a badly damaged tent that they quickly realized belonged to the Dyatlov group. The site baffled people and continues to this day.
Yikes.
And dun, dun, dun.
Yeah.
The student who found the tent said that no one was inside and that all of their belongings and shoes had been left behind.
Ew.
From diary entries and cameras found at the campsite, we know that on January 31st, the group arrived at the edge of a highland area, and in the wooded valley, they stashed extra food and equipment that they would need on their way back. The last day that would be accounted for was February 1st. The group had begun to move through the pass and planned to make a camp on the opposite side. But due to the worsening weather and decreased visibility, it seemed like they had deviated from their course. But instead of losing altitude and going back down, they decided just to set up camp for the night.
Okay.
So again, I'll show you like a map and it kind of shows where they were. Back to the initial discovery. From the tent, they discovered that 8 or 9 sets of footprints leading away from the tent were going towards the edge of a forest nearby. The footprints told them that the people were only wearing socks and that some seemed to have a single shoe on and some were even barefoot.
Oh, God.
After about 500 meters, the prints were covered with snow. At the forest's edge, the searchers found the remnants of a small fire and sadly the remains of 2 of the hikers. They were shoeless and dressed in only underwear.
What?
Yeah. The branches on a nearby tree were broken and suggested that one might have tried to climb up, maybe even trying to spot the camp. Between the trees and the camp, 3 more bodies were found. So not immediately, but they, like searchers, I guess, will go along and they will have a stick and they'll sort of like punch it down
under the snow
to see if they hit anything, right? So between the trees and the camp, 3 more bodies were found, Dyatlov being one of them. They were found in positions suggesting that they were trying to return to the camp. The remaining 4 travelers were found over 2 months later.
Oh.
And they were found on May 4th under 4 meters of snow in a ravine. They were able to surmise that the first hikers to perish had their clothes relinquished to the others. So most likely that's why they were in their underwear, because they had taken their clothes.
Oh, they stole them. Okay.
One was wearing the burned pants of one of the others and had a person's jacket tied around her foot. The first 5 bodies were all examined in the first months of the inquest and were found to have all died from hypothermia.
Yeah.
One hiker had a small fracture on their skull, but it was not life-threatening. However, the discovery of the 4 other bodies would shift the story and create a whole other side of this incident.
Ugh.
So 3 of the hikers had suffered fatal injuries. Tybo Brignol had a major skull damage. Dubanina, which is her last name, they go by like all their last names in this story, and Solotaryov had major chest fractures.
Huh.
A doctor explained the injuries as being so severe that the impact would have been comparable to a car accident. The bodies, however, had no external wounds associated with the internal fractures. So that was super weird.
So it's not like they fell, because they would have been all banged
You would
up.
Have seen that, yeah.
Hmm.
So this suggested a high amount of pressure had been the culprit. Dubanina, which I believe out of the 4 was the one woman. She had extreme injuries to her face. Her eyes, tongue, and part of her lips were missing.
Oh.
Yeah.
Animal.
And possibly, right? There's theories about it, which makes sense. So she was found face down in a stream. So the way that she was found was she was almost like in a kneeling position. And then there was rushing water entire time.
Just wore it off.
Yeah. And that's kind of what they think, which makes sense to me. So they hypothesized this could be the reason for her injuries. So basically it was a result of the death process in a wet environment. Makes sense,
sure.
I think.
Okay.
So here are some of the initial things that were found out. 6 hikers died of hypothermia, 3 of fatal injuries. There were no indications that there were any other people on the mountain or nearby. The tent had been ripped and cut from the inside.
Okay.
So this is something that really baffles people, is like a knife or something was used from the inside to cut up the tent. And I'll show you photos. So that's what confuses people. Why would they have ripped it all up from the inside, like they had to get out now?
Right. Well, and they were obviously running because some of them didn't have their shoes.
But that's the thing, is from what they see from the footprints, it didn't look like they were running. They calmly walked away. So that's what's weird, right?
Calmly walked away. Yeah, because they left all their stuff in there too,
yeah, because you'd be able to tell if people were running and stuff like that. So it's like they needed to leave quickly. They cut it all open, but they left calmly and on their own regard. They didn't see any other footprints, no animals, nothing.
Let me guess. One of these theories is possession.
Interestingly, no.
Oh, really?
But now it is. So the victims died 6 to 8 hours after their last meals. Traces from the camp showed that all members of the group left on their own accord. High levels of radiation were found on one of the victims' clothing.
Oh.
The fatal injuries could not have been caused by a human. The force was too strong and there was no damage to soft tissue. So again, yeah, that's kind of...
Makes no sense.
Yeah, you wouldn't have... If you fell, of course, you'd have bruising and things like that, and they didn't. So here are some strange things that happened around the case. More strange things. A man who attended the funerals when he was 12 years old said that the bodies looked as though they had a deep brown tan. And another family member said that their hair was silver. All of them had like silver to white hair. Weird.
I feel like frostbite makes your skin really dark.
And that's what I thought for the skin.
Yeah.
Because yeah, silver hair,
I don't know.
But the hair, I have no idea. A group of hikers that were about 50 kilometers south had reported that they had seen orange spheres in the sky the night of the incident.
Jesus.
I told you last time, I don't like abduction stuff.
I hate it. Really creeps me out. I hate it.
I know, and one of our other stories is kind of like that, too.
Oh, God.
Similar stories of these spheres were observed in the area during February to March by many witnesses. So here are the theories. An avalanche. This theory sees the group waking up panicked. They cut their way out of the tent and ran. They were poorly clothed because they had been sleeping, and they ran into the woods for shelter. They were separated, and one group made a fire. One group attempted to return to the site and froze to death. The last group was caught in the avalanche and buried under 4 feet of snow. The avalanche force created the injuries. So the evidence against it, though, is that the location has no evidence of an avalanche having occurred. There would have been debris and certain patterns visible in the snow, which makes sense. The other bodies would have been moved as well. If an avalanche came through there, it would have pushed them. Over 100 other expeditions have been held since, and none have ever reported an avalanche-like conditions.
Okay.
So it's not
a zone for them.
Place.
Hmm.
The terrain analysis shows that if somehow there had been an avalanche, it would have bypassed the tent anyway because of where they were. Dyatlov was also very experienced and would have never camped where there would have been potential in the path of an avalanche. So that makes sense too. I keep forgetting like they had a really, really experienced person who had done this hike before.
And they were experienced too.
And as I said, the footprints leading from the tent were inconsistent with people running. In fact, the footprints showed that they were walking at a normal pace.
Right, because run would have been a big stride.
Yeah, and you probably would have seen maybe people stumbled. I mean, you're not wearing any shoes and you jump out into the snow. Like, that would have been startling.
Yikes.
The next theory is that something called katabatic wind is what caused the incident. This is a really rare but violent event. Another incident in Sweden happened, and the topography of both sites were very similar. So the wind comes and it's super violent, so they're thinking the wind could have made it impossible to stay in the tent. They could have cut it out and gone into the woods, sure. Right? They believe the one group might have constructed a biovac shelter, which then collapsed, causing the pressure injuries. So could be, but again, I feel like they wouldn't have walked calmly if there was this crazy wind happening.
Right.
The next theory, I've never heard of this before, is called infrasound, caused by wind going around the mountain in a certain way and creates a vortex, which can produce infrared sound, which can create panic attacks in humans.
Oh.
Yeah. Some theorists believe that the hikers were driven from the tent as they were in physical and mental distress. They fled, and once out of the infrared sound, they regained their composure and then tried to find their shelter. Again, I feel like they would have been running, though, if you were panicked. The three that suffered traumatic injuries fell off a ledge and landed on the rocks at the bottom, which, again, the holes in that case are sort of like you would have had those soft tissue
damage for sure.
Yeah. The next is military testing. Some believe that the campsite was within range of a parachute mine test done by the Soviets. The loud explosions could have explained the fact that they fled. Being shell-shocked and panicked would have supported them being disoriented and not being able to find their way back to camp. There are records of these tests happening around this time, so it could be. Mm-hmm. Parachute mines detonate while still in the air rather than once they hit the ground. So this would support witnesses who saw glowing orbs in the sky.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And apparently injury to people within the blast are similar to those with the three hikers, that it was like a pressure
blast. From inside.
Yes. Mm. Some also believe that there could have been radiological testing being done as well, and this would coincide with the orange-looking skin and gray hair as observed by their family.
Oh. That, and you said there was like high level of
radiation on one of the clothing. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Hmm. So that one's kind of like, I think, the most possibly plausible. And you have to think too, like, maybe at that time, military testing, maybe they were trying to cover it up. Maybe they didn't want people to know.
Well, that's what I was going to say. They would never say that that's a, the military would never be like, exactly. Oh, we did,
yeah,
did that.
So there's a site at dyatlovpass.com, DYATLOVPASS. It's a really good site. So I'm going to put the link up on the blog. It's comprehensive. There are extensive photos, information, autopsy information, diary contents, maps, and a whole bunch of theories. And they have, wow, like all the photos from every camera that was found there. So it's a really good place if you want to know more about the incident. And like I was saying before, there are so many rabbit holes. Like I was like, I could do a whole episode on this.
Yeah.
It's crazy. But other theories range from altercations within the group. Yetis is a big one.
Yetis?
A Yeti. There's a photo that was found on one person's camera. Some people think it's a Yeti. I don't think so. I think it's just a man in the distance, like standing there. I'll show you the picture. I don't think it is because I feel like you can see he's just wearing clothes. But
is Yeti like a Sasquatch?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Hmm. Shrooms, that maybe they took some shrooms and went crazy.
Also a potential.
Which could,
who knows,
be
what's growing on that, yeah, mountain. Psychedelics.
Exactly. Murder by a local tribe. That one was really popular, but again, they didn't see like any footprints, like nothing like that. And a wolverine attack. That's honestly one where they think a wolverine came.
No marks of,
you would have,
yeah,
murder. Or even on the bodies too.
Yeah.
But the only thing we know for sure is that 9 people passed away on that mountain, and we will most likely never know what happened for sure. So what do you think of that one?
It's strange. The thing that I can get out of my head is the orange skin and silver hair. And now I'm like, do chemical attacks change your hair color?
Right. That's what I'm wondering. Okay. So this is a photo. Again, these will all be up on the blog, but this is a photo of them setting out.
Okay. Looks like the dead of winter in Russia. Yep.
So this is what they found when they came. Yes. That's what the tent looked like. So there's snow on top, and I mean, it just looks shredded.
Oh,
yeah.
So they recreated it?
Yeah. So they suspended it over a rope so they could see. And they, like, I mean, this website I was talking about has like a map out of every single cut that was made. There were attempts at cutting that didn't go through the fabric. So they like really intensely looked into this.
Hmm.
These are the two that were found next to the fire. So you can see, like, just wearing underwear, bare feet.
Oh, God.
And you can see tanned, but I agree with you. Like, when I saw it, I was like, I think that happens with hypothermia.
I think so.
So there's that. And then this is, like, they had to dig down. This is one of the ones who were going back to the camp.
Covered in the snow.
I think this one, actually, I think that's Dyatlov.
Yikes.
And then they have, like, a monument. So here's the map. This is where they were headed.
Okay.
So they had veered off and done their camp right here.
So the bodies really aren't that far from each
other. They're really not that far.
Or not that far from the tent.
No, no. They're really not that far from the tent. And I've seen things where they said they even had, like, they had a flashlight that they had put on top so that they obviously were planning on finding their way back.
Right.
Yeah, it's
like a flashlight on top of the tent.
On top of the tent. And they left it on. And when the tent was found, they found the flashlight was still on, still working. So they obviously were thinking, okay, we got to go, but we're going to put this here so that we can find our way back.
Straight.
Right. So then I'm sort of thinking, then I have to rule out shrooms and that, because you'd think they wouldn't have the wherewithal to do that. Because they would have just been panicked or
hallucinating. Well, and even the military testing, you would be panicked in that too.
Right.
You wouldn't be like, spotlight.
Yeah. So this next one is Canadian.
Woohoo!
My dad loves this one. As we were mentioning, I do not enjoy aliens. It really freaks me out.
Me too.
So
spooky bitches don't like UFOs.
No, I'm not a fan. So, but my dad loves all things space. So I told him this and he's like, oh, I have never heard of this before. Oh. So he was really excited. So hi, Dad, if you're listening. Okay, so this is the story of the Falcon Lake incident. The subject of this story was a man by the name of Stefan Michalik. He was a Polish immigrant and an industrial mechanic. One of his interests was geology, and he fancied himself kind of like an amateur prospector. So he would go out in his spare time and when he wasn't with his family, and he would prospect. So on May 20th, 1967, Stefan made his way out to Falcon Lake in Manitoba. And I think he had sort of been out here before and had seen an area where he was like, oh, it's got all these geodes and stuff that he wanted to go back and prospect.
Okay.
He was in the midst of prospecting for silver and quartz on the northern side of the lake when he heard a large group of geese honking loudly and taking off. So he looked up to see two cigar-shaped objects glowing red and hovering in the air about 45 meters away.
Oh, God.
I know. I would have just ran.
Cigar-shaped?
Yeah.
Strange.
Yeah. Stefan observed one of the objects descending and landing on a flat stretch of rock, and the other object hovered for a few seconds and then took off. And he described it as, like, faster than anything that he'd ever seen. And I mean, he's an industrial mechanic, so it's like he kind of would have some idea of how fast things can go.
It's true.
I know. Again, I would have been running, but okay.
Buried myself in a hole by now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stefan thought maybe this was a secret military craft of some sort. So again, they were talking about, they mentioned like 1967, like Cold War era type. So they were like, maybe, you know, that's what he thought, right? So he went towards the craft and he sat down and sketched it. And it sat there for over half an hour.
Wow.
Yeah. And, okay, I'm going to pull up some of these photos for you. So this is him with his goggles. He would wear his welding goggles when he did his prospecting, so he didn't get anything in his eyes. And...
Oh, fair. Yep.
So this Whoa. Is his sketch. I know. It's super detailed. This will be up on the blog. It's crazy. And so he just sat there for like half an hour and he was just, again, he's a mechanic, right? I know my husband's a mechanic and he would be like, wow. And, you know,
thinking about how it's running.
Exactly. So he sketched everything. So on this kind of craft, and it looks kind of like a UFO, like what you think a UFO looks like.
Like a flying saucer.
Yeah.
Vibe. Yeah.
And so it's got like this, he noted this grate on the side that had all these little circles. And then there was a door open.
Hmm.
So he finally decided to approach the craft. Again, being a mechanic, he thought maybe they were having some mechanical issues and he could help. Like, he just never thought anything about aliens. He was like, oh, some sort of military thing.
Idiot. Suspect the worst.
Yeah. So he approached the strange vehicle and later recalled the strong smell of sulfur and the whirring sound of motors and air hissing. The craft appeared to be cool now and was now silver metal rather than glowing red as it had been. So right. It was glowing red in the sky. Now it's cooled down. So I will note that later there was actually a piece of radioactive metal that was still highly radioactive that was later found embedded in the rock that this was sat on.
Crazy.
Yeah. And his son, I believe, has a piece of it still.
Wow.
Yeah. So Stefan noted that a door on the side was open and he could hear muffled voices inside. He couldn't tell what they were saying or even if it was English being spoken. So he called out to the occupants and he said something like, hey, do you Yankee boys need help?
Whoops.
And he said, like, you know, he kind of made like a joke, like, I won't, because he said the voices stopped.
Oh.
So then he was like, I won't give away any of your secrets. Like, do you need help? I'm a mechanic. But he actually, I think he spoke six languages. So he Wow. thought maybe they're not Canadian or American. So he tried it in Polish, Russian, German, I think Italian also, to like just say, do you speak
Yeah.
German? Do you speak blah, blah, blah. And there was no reply. He went closer to the craft and he couldn't figure out, like, he was looking and he just couldn't figure out how this was made. He could see no welding seams.
No seams.
Everything was completely smooth.
That's what you always hear about UFOs.
Yeah. Yeah,
they, like, exactly. Don't understand the construction.
Yeah. So he walked around to the open doorway and he put on his welding goggles. So this was in the middle of the day, but the lights that were coming from the door were so bright that he put those goggles on to look inside. He didn't see anyone or anything inside, but he noted the flashing and different colored lights inside. And, like, I just picture sort of like the, like, Enterprise or something, totally. You know, all these little blinking lights. The panel on the door slid shut in front of him and sealed. Stefan reached out to touch the craft and the hot metal melted the tips of his welding gloves. So welding gloves, you know.
And it's still that hot. Holy smokes.
Yeah. So I'm showing Brianna a picture of the welding gloves and they're melted on the
Well, thank God he fingers. Didn't actually step inside. He would have
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Or touched it if he didn't have gloves on. So the craft turned counterclockwise and Stefan remembers seeing a panel with a grid of holes, like we saw, come into view and it struck him in the chest with a blast of hot air.
Oh.
The blast sent him flying back and set his shirt and hat on fire. He ripped off his burning clothing and the craft flew away. So here's his shirt they found later.
Wow.
So it's all burned and you can see like
you
the little
grid.
You can
see exactly the grid marks.
Yeah. Wow. So exactly what he said. So Stefan was disoriented and nauseous, and he managed to stumble his way back to his hotel. A highway patrolman who had seen him did give a statement, like, to the RCMP that he did see him, and that he would just assumed that long weekend that he had, this is the most Canadian saying, too many wobbly pops.
Just destroyed himself.
Yeah. I was like, I haven't heard wobbly pops in forever.
Since high school. Yeah.
So for anyone who doesn't know what that means, it just means alcoholic drink.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Vodka waters, probably.
Yeah, exactly. So, again, like in non-Canadian terms, he just assumed that he was drunk. And he didn't, which I kind of thought was funny, he sees this drunk guy stumbling and he didn't help him. He just was like, oh, that guy's hammered, and then drove off.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, small town.
All his clothes are on fire. Let's leave him.
Yeah.
He's fine.
So once he got back to the hotel, he asked for help, but the local doctor was not at the town that weekend. He hopped on a bus and managed to make it back home where he was taken to the hospital. He told everyone about what happened at the lake and was being treated for a grid-like pattern of burns on his chest, severe nausea and disorientation. And in the following weeks, he actually suffered like extreme weight loss.
Weird.
Headaches and blackouts. And they did later find that he had radiation poisoning.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And so this next picture.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So now Brianne's looking at his burns. So it's crazy. It's exactly like, it's a grid-like pattern.
Like shot right into him.
Yeah.
So it must have been radiation.
Yeah. So there was an investigation and Falcon Lake residents remember military helicopters swirling overhead that summer. Both Canadian and American forces. And I always think, if it's just like some farmer who got a little drunk or whatever, that's a lot of presence. They obviously know something to think like, oh, we better go investigate.
Yeah.
You know, you think like they're always saying, oh, there's no extraterrestrials. Well, then why are you so quick to come and look around? Yeah. And all that manpower.
Yeah.
So the location's not that far from the American border. And along with the obvious UFO alien theories that were starting to take hold, people were also aware that this was during Cold War times, and maybe this was some sort of experimental craft.
From the Russians.
Yeah, maybe. There were reports from townspeople that there were even some people who said they were from NASA.
Yeah, they know something for sure.
Yeah. The search teams did end up finding Stefan's burned shirt. And so you saw the picture of it. Many places state that they found his hat and his gloves with the melted fingertips, just like he said. However, I actually found all the declassified reports from this case. Wow. So you can find them. It's on a government website and I'll link it.
Oh, really?
It's crazy. So you can read his like 18-page interview with the RCMP, his full original interview. And then there's all their like sort of reports about what happened.
Well, even the fact that they took that much interest in him.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So really interesting. So in one of the declassified documents, it did state that they couldn't find the exact place he was talking about. Obviously, he wasn't able to go out with them. He was really sick right after that, so he couldn't just go out with them. He tried to kind of tell them where it was, and they didn't find anything the first couple days. He was able to go the one day, but I think he was still kind of not super well. And so one of these reports says that he had gone out and found them himself. So I think that kind of raised some doubt with some people that, and even probably them, because they didn't witness the pieces out in the field. He was the one who found them and brought them to them.
And who found that chunk of radioactive in the rock?
That was found years later.
Oh, years later.
I don't know from who, though. There was, I think it was someone who was researching the case and had gone out, because they did find the location and they did note that it was a 15-foot diameter circle where every piece of vegetation was dead.
Oh.
Yeah. And then the trees around even had like heat damage. So, I mean, that supports it for sure. I still think there's something to be said, though, about the fact that all of the pieces of clothing were highly radioactive.
Yeah.
So how could this man have done that himself? Like, it just doesn't make sense.
No.
So, but definitely, I mean, that's an element to it, that they didn't find it in the field, that he did. But, like, say, and even the 15-foot diameter, that's a lot of work for what? Like, for a hoax? To be able to do that.
Well, and, like, the suspicious part of me is like, did they want to find it or did they just say they couldn't find it?
Right.
And he was like, no, I'll show you.
True. Exactly. So he was actually transferred to the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. Expert doctors and psychiatrists determined that he was not delusional, that they also believed that he was telling the truth. The burns flared up off and on, I think, through his life. And and his son later said that his father went to the grave telling the same story. Details never changed one bit. And he said that he, as he got older, however, his dad wished he had never said anything due to the attention and the scrutiny that it brought his family. So his son also said that to people who think it was made up, and I think this is totally true, he said, my father was a blue-collar industrial mechanic. If he hoaxed it, he was a freaking genius. And it's like, I agree. That's a lot of evidence to be.
And for what?
Exactly.
It didn't bring his family any good either.
Yeah. No, not at all. And his son actually wrote a book, I think a couple years ago, kind of recently, about everything and sort of his experiences with it and stuff like that. So that was really interesting. And he did say, too, when his dad came home and he sort of would go in to visit with him, because he would be just laying in this room, he said it was like extreme sulfur smell
in his body, like coming out of his body.
I think so. Extreme sulfur smell. And he said it also smelled like motor oil or something. And it's like, how could he hoax all of that? And why would you put yourself through radiation poisoning? And how would he even do that?
So he remained like sick his whole life.
I think he still would have like headaches and blackouts here and there. But yeah, apparently that grid pattern would show up here and there, like off and on.
Strange.
Really weird. Yeah.
You have to see the photo.
Like, oh, yeah.
It's bizarre.
Yeah. It's super weird. And everything that he said, I don't know. I don't think that he was lying, but that's just me.
No.
So the official government documentation determined that they could not come to a conclusion on what happened that day and what the craft may have been. The last thing I want to point out is that Stefan never once said it was aliens, and he maintained that till he died. So this story remains one of the most prolific cases of plausible alien evidence in the world. And like I was saying, you can read the actual transcript from May 24th, released by the Canadian government, of Stefan's actual interview with RCMP. There are some other really interesting articles as well, and I'll link those too. So, super interesting. And I have a picture. This is a piece of the metal that was found. This is the one his son has.
It's also very similar in time to Roswell, isn't it?
Yeah. And they said this one, they feel like has better evidence than even Roswell.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. So this is from the report. So I have an image here, but again, I'll link the actual report. But this is just from the report where they say, like, neither of these teams, investigation teams, were able to provide evidence which could dispute his story.
Mm.
And although the investigation has been completed, a satisfactory explanation or conclusion is still lacking. So even the government could not explain anything. So super interesting.
Funky.
So I'm never going to Falcon Lake because I'll be abducted.
Fuck no.
Yeah. Okay, so this one is another reincarnation one. So this one's kind of short, but since we loved it. Our other one. This is the story of Ryan Hammonds and his claim of remembering his past life when he was just 4 years old. So in 2009, his mom was startled by her little boy waking up, clutching his chest and screaming. And this occurred numerous times, and Ryan would claim that his heart exploded in Hollywood.
I don't even know what to say. I just got like a pain in my chest. I was like, ooh.
So little Ryan began to reveal more of his former life, and his mother became intrigued by the claims. He told her that he once lived in a home in Hollywood on a street with the name Rock in it. He also had three sons and a friend that he called Senator Fives. So his mom kind of like took all this in. Okay, like,
what 4 year old even knows the word senator?
Yeah, I know. So his mother was looking through a book about old Hollywood, and Ryan was looking over her shoulder. He got really excited by one photo and claimed the man was him. And furthermore, that the man he was posing with was named George. So his mom found out the man's name was Martin Martin.
Nailed it.
So Martin was the first name, and his last name was Martyn, Martin Martin. That's such a Hollywood.
Yeah.
Of course his name's Martin of Martin. Of course. And the man he was posing with was a film star named George Raft. And like, these are obscure people. Like, how would a four-year-old know who those people are? So Martin Martin passed in 1964. She came in contact with Martin's daughter, and she confirmed to Ryan's mother that Martin was a Hollywood agent, and he lived on North Roxbury Drive.
Whoa.
Yeah. So the street with a rock in it. He also did have three sons, and he once met with Senator Irving Ives.
So oh.
Senator Fives. I was like, oh, that's so cool. So going a step further, Martin's daughter agreed to meet with Ryan. During the meeting, Ryan was really standoffish, and he seemed very disinterested. He told his mom later that his daughter's energy had changed, which was kind of like...
The four-year-old said this?
Yeah, he said that his daughter's energy had changed. Once the meeting was over, Ryan let go of his past life, and a psychologist from UVA Medical Center, who specializes in reincarnation, told his mother that it was pretty common. Many times children will get the closure they need once they see people from their past lives have moved on.
Oh.
So that makes sense.
So the daughter's grown and moved on.
Yep. And so that was like all he needed, I guess.
Gives me like a wave of nausea for some reason. I'm like, whoa.
That's crazy. I almost like feel a little bit bad for his daughter because maybe she was sort of like...
She was ready for information or something.
Yeah. But I mean, maybe all she needed was like confirmation too, to be like, oh, he has a loving mom and happy family.
My one cousin, she's like really into acting, mm-hmm. wants to be an actress. And she went to see like a medium. Mm-hmm. I can't even remember where in Canada it was. She's lived in a few cities, but they had said like, you were murdered in Hollywood, like in the 60s. And ever since you told me that, I was like, totally. She does her hair always like vintage, like the style. She has like classic face. And I was like, yeah, totally makes sense.
Huh. And so then she's super into acting. And
well, and they were like, you're coming back this time to do it.
Oh,
isn't that wild?
Super
like
cool.
To finish what you didn't finish before.
I mean, I don't love that she was murdered, but I love like
that you're doing it again.
Really interesting. Yeah. Okay, So it's a surprise because I don't want you to know.
Oh my God, I'm already scared.
Don't be scared. You're going to be excited.
Okay.
Because this was your idea.
Which one?
So the very last thing I have for you, I told you, was a surprise. So for listeners out there, I don't think I included this actually in the last episode. But when Brianna and I did the last episode, we were talking about reincarnation. And you brought up a name you said I have to look into.
Oh, yeah. Oh, good. This remember? Is so good. Yeah.
Okay.
Mary Venom.
Yes. So I did. So you weren't 100% sure of the name. You did tell me Mary Venom.
Yeah. Right?
So I did look into this and it is so interesting.
Yeah, it's a good one. I'm so excited.
Oh, yes. My gosh. I love it. So yes, I have to share it for everyone.
It's delicious. It's such a wild story.
Oh, it's so crazy. So for your listening pleasure, here is the story of Larancy Venom, the Watsika Wonder. So her name is Mary. So it was Mary Larancy Venom. And, okay. But people called her Rancy. That
right.
was like her nickname.
Rancy.
So yes, for everyone out there being like, really, her name was Venom. It's spelled V-E-N-N-U-M. And it's a crazy, amazing name. I was like, I wish my last name was Venom.
I know.
It's super cool.
Yeah, you're like, bleh.
Yeah. I am changing my name now. So Mary Larancy Venom, lovingly known as Rancy, was born in 1864 in Iowa to loving parents Thomas and Lorinda Venom. Okay, so here's her mom and dad.
What a cool photo.
Yeah.
The dad super looks cool. like Abe Lincoln.
Yeah. I feel like everyone looked like Abe Lincoln.
You're right. That was the style.
Yes. So yeah, I have some really cool photos, so I'll put those up on the blog. So they moved to Watsika in 1873, but in July of 1877, their daughter, only 13 at the time, began to act strangely. She would get nauseous and have dizzy spells, and one day had turned to her mother and said, "Ma, I feel bad. I feel mighty queer." And she collapsed into a catatonic state for 5 hours. So this began to happen daily, where she would lie stiff with slow breath and her temperature below normal.
Like almost dead.
Yeah. Though she would often awake feeling refreshed, she also began to speak while asleep. She would speak of angels, demons, spirits of the dead, and even spoke about her late brother and sister. I didn't really find out, but I feel like maybe her brother and sister passed before she was born or something, or when she was
probably.
Really young.
Probably.
Because I've never seen any photos of
all of them.
All of them. It was like just her. At this time in the U.S., spiritualism was at an all-time high. And I talk about spiritualist movement in one of my BC episodes.
Yeah. Are these the Ouija sisters? No.
No. Yeah, they played a prank on their mom. And it got out of hand and they never told anyone until they were way older. And their sister, I think, did find out, their older sister, and kind of exploited it.
Yeah.
So anyway, this whole movement was started by them. But
got it.
Right. So soon Rancy would be experiencing these spells for up to 8 hours a day and speaking in other people's voices. She would describe places she had never been in immense detail, though upon waking had no memory of what she said. This, of course, got the attention of many people around who believed that she was a medium. Thomas and Lorinda contacted many physicians to come help their daughter. The only one who diagnosed her with mental illness and recommended that she be sent to the State Insane Asylum in Peoria. The Venoms felt as if they had no choice, and they began to prepare to send her away. In January of 1878, however, local spiritualist and town founder Asa Roth came to the Venoms and begged them to reconsider. He himself had an experience in the matter with his own daughter, and she didn't survive the asylum. Mm. Strangely, his own daughter, Mary Roth, had suffered in her short life, much the same as Rancy was. Born in 1846, at just 6 months old, Mary Roth began to exhibit fits much like the ones that Rancy was experiencing. Soon she was falling into long trances, speaking in other voices, and she also appeared to suffer clairvoyant abilities and could see with a blindfold on. However, Mary crumbled under the power of her abilities and became extremely violent. Mm. She attempted to commit suicide, it's believed, by cutting up her arm with a razor when she was just 19. It was after this that she was taken to the asylum in Peoria. Treatments, of course, at that time, like now we know,
torturous.
Did nothing to help.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it was torture. They were talking about specifically at that one, and I'm sure many other ones, but like water torture. I mean, you'd That's be insane. Submerged into scalding water and then into freezing cold water.
Great.
Yeah. Mary passed away on July 5th, 1865. It was then that the Roffs became spiritualists in hopes of communicating with their daughter. They convinced the Venoms to allow them to mesmerize Rancy with the help of Dr. Stevens. The family agreed, and the doctor mesmerized Rancy. She began to take on very aggressive and harmful spirits, finally throwing up her arms and collapsing. This supposedly allowed a gentler spirit, whom she referred to as an angel, to take over. Rancy's whole demeanor changed, and this angel turned out to be Mary Roff, who informed the room that Rancy needed time away in heaven to be cured, and that when she was ready to return, Mary would then leave. LaRancy seemed to know everything about Mary and everything that she had known. She was very happy to be back in the presence of her father and treated the Venoms like strangers and asked to go home. Mrs. Roff and daughter Minerva were approaching the house and Rancy exclaimed, "Here comes Ma and Nervy," using a pet name she had called her sister as a child over 12 years ago. Rancy as Mary eventually asked the Venoms if she may go stay with the Roffs until Rancy was better. When asked how long this would be, she replied that the angels would let her stay until sometime in May, so approximately 3 months. They reluctantly agreed, and the Roffs picked up their daughter, excited for their second chance. On the way to the Roff home, she pointed out the old house and asked why they were not stopping there. The Roffs had moved from that house when Mary passed away. Once at the new house, she pointed out the old piano and sat down to play her favorite songs. She also acknowledged the time that they had sought out other mediums to contact her and spoke of the afterlife and her own burial. I think one said that like she described everyone who was standing around her at her burial. So crazy. So, I don't know if I could handle
if that I was your daughter. That. I'd be
that'd be freaky.
Oh.
And especially coming, like, you're looking at someone else, but she's talking, like, exactly like your child would have. That'd be really freaky. Well, even for
the Venoms to be like,
yeah,
okay, child, yeah, go stay with this other family till the angels bring back our,
yeah,
your other soul.
Yeah, very strange. During Mary's time back at the home, many visitors and spiritualists came from miles around to hear her stories of the afterlife. She would also contact spirits and deliver messages to people visiting. And I read one thing where it said during one sort of like seance type thing they did, she left Rancy's body and went into a man's body who was like standing by the door and then laughed in her voice and then came back to Rancy's body, like almost to show she could.
Oh my
God. I know. I was like, I don't like reading. I was getting really freaked out reading it because I'm like, oh God.
Just bothers you.
The family would even test her with things that they knew Mary would only know. One time her mother asked if she remembered the family moving to Texas in 1857 when Mary would have been 11. She said she remembered quite well and noted specifics like seeing the Indians along the Red River, in quotes, and, quote, playing with the young daughters of a family named Reeder, who were traveling in the same party. So very specific.
Yes.
That I don't know how Rancy could have figured out, because some skeptics were saying, I mean, they lived in the same town. Maybe she heard of the girl who went crazy or whatever. But I mean, those little details.
So this is like a soul in purgatory, yeah. We're guessing.
Maybe. I don't know. Like, I don't know. Strange. I've never, like, this story is so different than anything I've read, because it's like I've never read ones where they specifically talk about like angels and.
Yeah. The afterlife.
Yeah. When the Venoms would visit their daughter periodically during that time, she would treat them as if they were strangers. Though over the course of her time there, she would eventually treat them as family friends. She reconnected with old friends, and others in the community quickly became comfortable communicating with the girl. So they originally thought, like, this chick's nuts, which I would too.
Totally.
But once they talked to her and people who had known Mary, they quickly concluded that they didn't think she was insane. She was a well-mannered and polite girl. And over this time, she was monitored by Dr. Stevens. At one point, he asked her about her former life, and he asked her of cutting her arm. She went to pull up the sleeve on the arm the scars would have been on, and then stopped as if remembering something. And
oh,
was
no.
And was quoted as saying, "Oh, this is not the arm. That one's in the ground."
Oh, God.
Do you not get the biggest chills? Like, I was so scared reading this. I was like, oh, my
Jesus
God.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. She went even further, describing to Dr. Stevens that she had seen his daughter in heaven and described her right down to the X-shaped scar on her cheek. I think she, in this it had said that she had died from like an illness, you know, that went around at that
this
time.
This is the psychologist or the doctor's daughter.
Yeah, the doctor's daughter. And yeah, she had some sort of little surgery thing on her face at one point. So she had a scar on her cheek. And she never knew Dr. Stevens. This was someone after her death. And she also described his home in Janesville in impossible detail. When the time had come for Rancy to return, Mary had become despondent and withdrawn. She informed Mrs. Roth that she would have to leave soon and spent the day and the following days saying tearful goodbyes to family and old friends. Rancy returned and then after a few minutes allowed Mary to come back for two more weeks. On May 21st, Mary left and Rancy returned. Her demeanor had changed completely, and she asked where she was and to be taken home. She reunited with her parents and returned to her life completely restored, as Mary said that she would be. She soon got married to a man named George Binning and moved to another town, started a new life, had kids, and in the following years, she would visit the Roths and allow Mary to come through. One article did say that her husband put a stop to that. He thought that it was not healthy, which I could see. And she essentially lived out a full and happy life. She passed away in 1952.
So she could still channel other Mary.
I don't think she did sort of a lot of channeling once she was back. And I'll just show you. She was all beautiful, actually.
Stunning.
Like this picture of her with her first born child. I think she had a daughter.
What a gorgeous photo.
Yeah, it's a really nice picture. And then this was her. That's on her. There's a website called Find a Grave. And then you can see like if people have obituaries and all this stuff.
Findagrave.com.
Yeah. I use it a lot, actually. And you can actually leave like virtual flowers, which is kind of nice. And I actually used it a lot when I was doing like family research. So it's kind of cool. But
is there any like research on what she says about heaven, or she never talks about it?
There's a couple books because she was called the Watsika Wonder. This is one of the most prominent cases of truthful possession, really.
It's wild.
I think too, like I think of possession and I think like a demon. So yeah. I was like really creeped out. I'm like, what is happening? But this one's kind of interesting because it doesn't seem like it was anything harmful. And then after, she just seemed to be fine. And I don't think she had all of those sort of catatonic states. I don't think that happened anymore.
This is like a story that really makes you realize you're just like a big meat sack.
Yeah.
Like you're like, we care so much about this physical time. And it's like, it doesn't really matter.
No, it doesn't at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this brings us to the end of the episode. So thank you so much for listening. As I mentioned, this is the season finale. I hope you all have a happy holiday. So I will be back in April of 2020. So be sure to follow me on social media for updates and the exact season 2 premiere date, which I'll announce in the spring. Be sure to check out the blog for photos and links that correspond to the stories in this episode. You can find that at realscarypodcast.ca. If you have your own stories, suggestions, or comments, please send them to realscarypodcast@gmail.com. As I mentioned, you can follow me on social media. I'm on Facebook and Instagram at @realscarypodcast. And thank you so much to Brianne for being my guest today. And thank you for the last story.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for having me.
Of course, check out Brianne's amazing website at briannemarie.photo. And I will, of course, have a link up on the blog for that as well. Please follow her on Instagram, as I said, at @briannemarie_photo. You will fall in love with her. as I am. She's amazing, artistic, and I said goth meets glitter.
Yes. Yeah? Goth meets glitter. It's perfect.
It's
perfect.
It's the right amount of dark and light,
I think. Yeah.
And I believe you're booking for 2020 right now, are you not?
I'm actually, kind of. I'm booking for 2021 now.
Whoa! Oh my goodness. See? She's high in demand. Okay, yeah. So if you have an event, a wedding, engagement, family session, marketing campaign, anything that needs photographing, contact this lovely lady and you will not be disappointed.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So lastly, Brianne, I want to give you a tiny sneak peek of what people can expect from season 2.
Woohoo!
That's your other surprise.
Yay!
So I have a story of a bar that was once a funeral home.
Oh, God.
And believe me when I tell you, so the experiences here are, I think, some of the most active I've heard so far.
Oh.
This is the place with the ghost photo I sent you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Wasn't that Calgary?
That's in Calgary. Oh, God. Yeah. So next I had this crazy interview with this Curio's shop in Ontario. And this place is so amazing. And he has incredible stories. Like, they had a mummified hand from like an Egyptian priest.
How did that come to them?
I know. I was like, how do you get all of these things?
So how did you even fly with that?
Yeah. So that's going to be in the episode 2. I ask him, like, how do you come into contact with these things? And they have creepy looking dolls. They have Victorian era taxidermy.
Very cool.
Yeah. They have like teeth and medical instruments, medical skeletons, like all sorts of things. It's amazing. So I'll also be delving into the Sasquatch, Wendigo, and other creatures that have been spotted around Canada. So that'll be really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then lastly, I can tell you I have incredible stories coming from a historical village in Eastern Canada.
Wow.
The history of this place is so cool on its own. But the tour director was telling me the first year of haunted tours there, they had to rewrite their entire script because they had so many things happening that happened during their first year of tours.
Jesus.
That they wanted to include it, obviously, for the next year. So they had to rewrite everything. And she said it's a daily occurrence there. It's amazing. Full-bodied apparitions.
Oh.
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah.
Nope.
And I think this is the first place where I've had a malevolent spirit.
Really?
So
it's kind of neat that it's the first one, though.
Yeah, I know, because most places spirits
are nice.
Yep, maybe mischievous, but nothing bad. So as I said, come back. I can't wait to bring you all more true Canadian paranormal stories. In the meantime, tell your friends and family to listen. Share the crap out of it.
Yes.
Word of mouth is awesome. And make sure to subscribe and leave a rating for me on whichever platform you listen on. If you have a suggestion of other platforms you want to see it on, shoot me an email or a message on Facebook. Until next time, this is your friendly neighborhood host, Elise, and
Brianne.